welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Joining me here, Matt Myers, MLB.com national editor. We got a pretty cool show for you today. We have kind of a big piece of news on one of our favorite new metrics. We're going to talk about a pretty interesting pitcher you almost never think about, one of last year's hardest hitting teams who just decided to stop hitting barrels. We're going to induct a new player into the Hall of Fame, but first, and most importantly, Matt Myers would like to offer a public apology. Go right ahead.
As the diehard listeners will know, last week I gave a pretty impassioned endorsement of Luis Perdomo as my favorite new pitcher of 2017.
San Diego Padres starter Luis Perdomo, for the most of you who don't know that.
And then I subsequently on Twitter, I made an impassioned plea for people to go pick him up in fantasy. At the time when I tweeted, only 4% of – he was owned in only 4% of Yahoo leagues. Yahoo is MLB.com's fantasy partner. A recommendation that, mind you, was retweeted and seconded by none other than MLB.com fantasy expert Fred Zingy. So I'm not alone on this island. And at least one person I know of has told me they took me up on that endorsement. And Perdomo subsequently went out on Saturday against the Diamondbacks. Three innings pitched,
11
hits, 8 earned runs, 2 strikeouts. So,
Let's say the Diamondbacks are a better hitting team this year than I think people thought they might have been.
Yeah, Jake Lamb, I think, hit a homer off from that, and Jake Lamb has been very good this year.
Was it in Arizona?
No, was it?
Oh, forget it. I'm trying my best here. No, forget it.
So yeah, it wasn't great. If it makes you feel any better, you know, I went down with the ship. I had picked up Luis Perdomo on my fantasy team, and I play in a weekly head-to-head league, and I lost to one of my best friends solely because of Luis Perdomo's poor performance. So I'm right there. For those of you who picked up Luis Perdomo on my recommendation, I apologize, but I'm right there with you feeling the pain. I will say, in his previous 4 starts, he went exactly 6 innings in each of them, 24 innings pitched total, 8 earned runs total, 26 strikeouts in 24 innings with only 6 walks, a ground out, fly out ratio of more than 2-1 in every single one of those outings. So I am still a believer, although I will say I did bench him this week facing the Nationals, so I'm not as much of a believer as maybe I was last week. So there's going to be some growing pains, as we said last week, a Rule 5 pick from last year who had barely pitched above a ball, still refining the old sinker that he's got. But he's still an interesting player, but I apologize for those of you who wore it in fantasy last Saturday.
Well, respect for stepping up to the plate with that one. Even the best pitchers have their moments, and he's still an interesting guy, as you said. So that public shaming out of the way, let's talk about catch probability, right? So this is our favorite new tool of the year. And when we first introduced this over the winter, we said catch probability is based on 2 things. How far did you have to go for outfielders to get there? And how much time did you have to get there out of the pitcher's hand? We call that opportunity time, right? How far did you have to go? How long did you have to get there? And that right there is an enormous part of outfield defense. That's a huge portion of being a good outfielder or not. But we also said that as time went on, we were going to add some more nuance to that to really like refine it a little further. The first thing we said we were going to do in the early part of the season was add direction, because it's obviously a little bit harder to go straight back than it is to come in on the ball. And it's not yet the end of May, so I'll still call that the early part of the season. And we've done that. We're ready to talk about that. So that has been added in, and we can tell you a little bit about how that works. And basically what I'm doing now is just taking a conversation I had with Tom Tango and doing my best to regurgitate it, because this is all the very good work of our colleague Tom Tango. So if you think about it, for every outfielder, like their starting position, you have the angle to where they're going to go. And we are defining this as the angle to their sprint speed, like the angle to where they're really going after the ball. And at first, Tom looked at it. He broke it down into 72 different 5-degree slices around the fielder, which adds up to 360 degrees. And very simply, what he did was for each slice, he took the catch probability based on distance and time. He compared the actual catch probability in each of those directions, and he compared it to the expected. And for most of those directions, there was no change whatsoever, because you know the actual and the expected would be very similar. But going straight back, that is where the actual, that's where the difference was. That's really the only direction that he saw any difference at all. And what this eventually became was not 5. It was not 72 5-degree slices. We simplified it, and now it's 6 60-degree slices, right? So there's 3 of them coming in, 3 of them going back. So that's kind of where it's come. So of those 6 60-degree slices, the only one that actually has any change in catch probability for direction out is the one that's going straight back, right? And so the other five are unchanged. And so I should clarify, what does back mean? And it's kind of a weird world we live in where you actually have to explain what going back actually means. Because I remember we talked about this like 2 years ago internally, how to define this. Back and forward mean going to the home plate and away from home plate, right? So if you think about it like visually on a field, if you're the right fielder, if you're going in, you're going in towards home plate. You're not going in like towards the first base dugout, like down. Do you know what I mean? Does that make any sense at all?
It does make sense. It's a little weird, but it makes sense.
It's a little weird. So basically, if you think about like the North Pole is home plate, right? So yeah, the way we define it is 0 degrees is going straight on in, and 108 degrees is going straight back, right? And then 90 this way, 90 that way. So that's the way we've defined it. So back is really going between 150 degrees and 210 degrees. So 180 straight back, 30 degrees in either direction. I hope any of that has made sense to everybody whatsoever, how we've defined it.
Think about it, you know, for a left fielder, it's basically like running towards the left center field gap and towards the foul pole, essentially, right? If you're a left fielder, like, so just sort of think of those. I mean, that's essentially what it is, right? You're almost like a V.
Exactly right. And there's a certain point where you're going too far in and you're not actually going back. You're just going, you know, to your left. And so that's actually a good point. So this is kind of the version one of this where it is sort of a hard line there. You know, there's those lines, and if you cross them, you're back or you're not. As time goes on, you know, Tom will smooth that out a little bit, because you could be like 1 degree on either side and get credit for it or not get credit for it, which isn't ideal, but it's the first implementation of this. So it's pretty cool. So that explains how do you define whether a player was going back or not. So that's the answer to that. But then what happens if you say, okay, this ball was going back? Well, what does that do? How does that change the catch probability? So what Tom has done here is he shifted the data by 1 foot per second. So let me explain that. We introduced sprint speed, and we defined that as feet per second in a player's fastest 1 second window, right? And as we said last year, if you caught the ball, the major league average was about 27 feet per second. The really slow guys are, you know, 22, 23 feet per second. Hamilton, Buxton, like 30, 31 feet per second. So that's
Buxton actually had one play last week over the weekend where he didn't catch it, just missed a diving play where he went over 32 feet per second, which I think is the highest we've seen this year.
It's like as fast as a human can do on a baseball field. And obviously that's a little different than like a Usain Bolt, where he's, you know, going in a straight line. He's not trying to catch the ball. He's got the starting gun. That is about as fast as I think we'll ever see a human run on a baseball field. So Byron Buxton, as fast as Billy Hamilton, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, so the way we defined this stuff before is if you had a 5-star play, as you just kind of alluded to, that would be in the band of about 30 feet per second and north of that. So 30 feet per second to 32 feet per second. And that's just in a regular direction. But if you're going back, you get a little bit more credit for that because it's harder. So now a 5-star play going back is 29 feet to 31 per second. You get that extra foot per second back. You've shifted the scale. And why did we do that? Because that keeps the conversion rate based on those bands on a similar scale. We don't want, if you're going back, all of a sudden it's way, way easier to get 5-star plays than coming in or out. It should still be consistent for everybody. So that's like the nuts and bolts of it. And you know, I'm going to write about this and feel free to ask questions about it. But then the real question is, okay, well, how many plays does that actually affect? And so far in 2017, we're almost 2 months into the season, it's affected 300 plays over, you know, thousands of outfield catches, right? And the majority of those plays, about 82% of those plays, saw catch probability changes of 5 points or fewer. Because basically it's like, it was an easy pop-up where it was like a 95% catch probability, but you did go back for it. So now it's like a 92% catch probability. Doesn't change it that much, but you get your little amount of credit for it. 47 of those 300 plays, or 16%, saw changes between 6 points and 20 points, which can be kind of sizable at the high end of that. That can change a 3-star play into a 4-star play or another direction. And then we had 8 plays, so under 3%, but 8 plays saw changes between 21 points and 30 points, which is actually a pretty serious change. And the reason that the catch probability can change differently for different plays is, as I said, if it was an easy play, it's still going to be an easy play, just slightly, you know, more credit for it. But if it was a difficult play and then you add in that you had to go back, all of a sudden that's a ball that not as many outfielders get to. So we had 8 plays that had a change in catch probability between 21 points and 30 points, and the top 3 of them have all happened in like the last 4 days, which is fun. One of these plays is actually going to be our Hall of Fame play for the day.
That's a good teaser, right?
But
there.
It's an amazing teaser. I know. I mean, we're very good at this. We're not going to mention that one now. But so the two plays at the top of the list that had the biggest difference, these plays changed 29 percentage points. And it's interesting. They actually both were 55% catch probability before and 26% catch probability now. So they were three-star plays, and now they're on the borderline of being a five-star play. And I should add, I don't think our leaderboards on Baseball Savant account for this just yet. They will in the very near future, if you're wondering why there's some slight discrepancies. But it's really interesting. Last night, Justin Upton had one of these plays for the Tigers playing in Houston, and it was a 55% catch probability play without the direction added. And when you put the direction in, all of a sudden, that's a very impressive play.
Yeah, well, and it was particularly impressive because, you know, I don't really think of Upton as a standout outfielder, but he made the play look pretty. It was a hit into the left center field gap in Houston. And he's just going back towards, you know, as I was sort of describing before, like essentially like the left, like whatever the what would typically be the wall marking where it says like, you know, 385 or whatever on the wall, going back to in that direction from his starting spot in left field. And he caught it on the run. He did not need to dive, but he was definitely going full speed and out. You had to sort of do like a little like lunge, but it was an excellent catch. Interesting thing about Upton, because I was like looking, I was like, oh, maybe this is, you know, his best catch he's ever made. Because as I was saying, I don't think he's not a standout guy to me. This year he's 4-for-7 on 4-star catches, which impressed me. But last year, he was 1-for-26 on 5-star opportunities. So there's definitely, he's definitely, clearly there's a line for Justin Upton of what he can and can't do. But certainly up until that line, he seems like he's pretty good.
I mean, it's kind of the difference between talent and consistency, right? Because you need both of those things. But every once in a while, even a guy you don't think of as being a great fielder can come up and make one of those great plays. It's kind of, you know, the second guy on the list who also tied with the biggest adjustment in catch probability is Aaron Judge. And this was, I think, over the weekend. It was a couple days ago. I was out of town, and he made kind of a very similar play, but from right field, kind of going towards center. Now, not so far towards center that it wasn't going back. It was still going back, but it was kind of back and to his right. So he'd started, you know, at a traditional right field spot and almost hit the wall in right center field to make a diving catch that really looked fantastic, actually better than it seemed at the time.
Yeah, no, and the thing about what's interesting about that play is it showed you what a unique talent Aaron Judge is. Now, he's not someone who's, based on his size, he's not someone I would expect his speed to necessarily age that gracefully. But like on that play, you know, 4-star catch, he was like at like 29 feet per second. Like he was running at elite. I mean, that's, you know, I looked it up just for a little context compared to his Yankee teammates, you know, Jacoby Ellsbury and Brett Gardner, two guys known for their speed. Granted, they're in their 30s now. Neither of them has run as fast this season as Aaron Judge did on that play.
That's, I honestly can say I did not know that, and that's amazing. I'm so happy that I know that now.
Once he gets going, he can really move. He's stolen a few bases. Like I said, I wouldn't expect this speed to last, you know, for Aaron Judge, considering he's 6'7", and we kind of know how players age. But right now, he is, like, his freakish, the nature of his freakish athleticism goes beyond just hitting the ball 120 miles an hour.
Yes, which is I think a really big deal for the Yankees. So that's kind of how we're going about this, and I think it's cool. As we said, we're going to make more changes in the future. I think we'd like to account for batted ball spin because, you know, the corners, a hook and a slice, and all that can matter. But for now, this is our kind of first big second step. So that's cool, and you're going to see, when you see the things reported now on Twitter and in video, you will see them with the catch probability direction included. As I said, we need a minute to get the leaderboards up to date, so that might be slightly out of sync for a little bit, but we're getting there. So I think that's cool. Please let us know what you think about it. A lot of other stuff to talk about, but before we move on, a quick minute to talk about the MLB Pipeline podcast, which focuses on all things draft and prospect related. And the draft is really coming up soon, isn't it? The Pipeline's draft and prospect gurus, Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, join Tim McMaster each week to talk about what's going on in the universe of MLB's future stars. Last week, they unveiled their 2017 MLB mock draft, led by high school right-hander Hunter Green, who actually joined the show to talk about life as the potential number one pick, which is pretty cool. So search for MLB Pipeline in iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts and click subscribe.
Yeah, we also had a really cool piece on Green on the site today. Mayo went out and spent a few days with him. We're rolling out kind of a series on Hunter Green, who might become the first high school right-hander to ever go number one overall in the draft, which is kind of amazing. Has never happened. I mean, Green has hit 102. 17 years old. He's at 102 on the radar gun. That's something.
That is a name to remember, and the MLB draft is in just a couple of weeks. So that'll be very cool. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about a pitcher that, I don't know, depending on what kind of baseball fan are you, might have been dreaming on this pitcher for a number of years, or you may very well have never heard of him. Jesse Hahn, who is a starting pitcher for Oakland, and we're going to explain why he's so interesting in just a second. Did you know, and I just learned this today, he was a high school teammate of Matt Harvey? I had no idea.
And I, as someone who sort of likes to think of themselves as a... I went maybe aficionado of Northeast amateur baseball, at least relative to the masses. I'm a little disappointed myself that I did not know this, frankly.
Yeah.
I did not know that he was a fellow, I guess, Mystic High School alum.
I had no idea. So Jesse Hahn is...
Or Groton, whatever they were.
The starter for Oakland. If you know anything about him, it's that he has a lot of injuries. He actually tore his UCL in his final college start. He missed all of 2011 with Tommy John after being picked by Tampa Bay in 2010. Missed half of 2015 with a forearm strain. Missed a big part of 2016 with a strained right shoulder. And fortuitously for this podcast, strained his triceps on Tuesday and may be going on the disabled list. So maybe not our best timing, but I still find him really interesting. And not just because he was in a couple of interesting deals. He was traded from Tampa to San Diego in the Logan Forsythe, Matt Andreese, Brad Boxberger deal. And then later that year traded to Oakland in the Derek Norris deal. So he's been with Oakland for a couple years. And there's really two reasons why I find him fascinating. Number one is that if you look at the 2017 curveball spin leaders, he is number two on the list. He has an average spin rate of just about 3,000, 2,998. The major league average is 2,501. So we're talking about like 500 RPMs per minute above average. That's number two to Austin Pruitt of Tampa Bay, who I think we've talked about before. Of 121 guys who've thrown at least 50, he has the second highest above some guys we've talked about before. We know that Jeremy Hellickson has a great curveball. Interestingly enough, Sonny Gray, who came off the disabled list and looked really good, he's on this list as well. We know that Charlie Morton has had a good curve. Jonathan Holder, we've talked about. And what I do find fascinating about this top 10 list, I'm just diverging for a second from Jesse Hahn, Joe Kelly's on this list. We've been talking about Joe Kelly for like 3 years as a guy who has amazing fastball velocity, but like completely unimpressive spin. And here he is with a high spin curveball. I learned something about Joe Kelly today.
Joe Kelly, who's throwing 101 regularly out of the bullpen.
Yeah, and not even doing that well with it. That's the most incredible part. So anyway, Jesse Hahn has an incredibly high spin curveball. And, you know, as we've talked about many times before, if you have a high spin curveball, that tends to get more movement vertically. It can bury it into the dirt. Higher spin curveballs are harder to make contact with. They're harder to make solid contact with. Low spin curveballs may stay up and then land about 500 feet away in the bleachers. So it is good to have a high spin curveball. It's his most likely his best pitch. It's got a 36% strikeout rate against his curve. So if you know nothing about Jesse Hahn so far, you know he's got a very high spin curveball. And of course, that's going to interest us on this show. Now, I thought this was interesting too. We've been using our numbers to come up with expected weighted on base. And weighted on base is very similar to on base percentage, except you get increasingly more credit for the way you get on base. It's not the same value for every type. Home run is better than a double, is better than a single, is better than a walk, etc. And based on hit probability, based on, you know, the quality of contact you allow, we can put a value on how likely you were to have given up a hit, even if your terrible defense didn't really turn it into an out. And we roll in real-world strikeouts and walks, and we can come up with an expected outcome. You can do it expected batting average, but here we're going to do it expected weighted on base. So I looked at 148 starting pitchers who've had at least 50 plate appearances against them in each of the last 2 years, and I looked at, you know, who's the biggest improvers, right? Who have made the biggest steps forward? And on this top 10 list is Zach Greinke, unsurprisingly. Alex Wood, who's been unbelievable. Jesse Hahn is number five on this list, and I would say he's actually number four on this list of guys who are going to pitch anytime soon, because Shelby Miller is one of those guys. And I think that gets a little bit to how this list at the top is sort of put together, because he's an improver. All these guys are, yes, and that's partially because they were really just dreadful last year. The number one guy on this list is, and I actually don't know which is the right way to pronounce his name, so I'm going to guess Jose Berrios. Berrios? I don't even know. You don't know either, because you're not jumping in.
But he was my 2016 AL Rookie of the Year pick, and so a year late on him.
And he looked awful last year, and then in a couple starts this year, and in the WBC, he's looked phenomenal.
I mean, if this is another aside right here, if the Berrios we've seen the last, you know, month or three or four outings that he's had is quote unquote real for this year, I am fully on board Twins as a playoff contender.
This year. I know. I say next year. That's a different
cut. As a wild card contender, I'm talking about as a wild card contender. They basically just like pulled a number two starter out of thin air. And with the way Santana's pitching, if
Santana can continue pitching like 1999 Pedro Martinez, then yes, I'm in. But anyway, I agree. You know, I love Byron Buxton. We've talked about the Twins a lot. But yeah. So anyway, Jesse Hahn has made the fifth largest step forward. And now partially he wasn't very good last year. That's part of it. But the league average weighted on base is 327 over the last 2 years. And he right now so far is at 293. I mean, that's pretty good. And that's lower than a lot of other guys in this list. Even Shelby Miller, who was pitching pretty well, is at 288. So he's gone from being extremely below average to being above average. I'll give you another name here. Luis Severino, who's been really pretty good this year, he's at 310. So in at least one sense, Jesse Hahn has outpitched Luis Severino.
He's interesting. The tricep thing is a little disappointing. Hopefully he's not on the shelf for too long, because Now I can start paying attention to him more as well.
Well, that's kind of the idea, right? I don't have any further deep thoughts about Jesse Hahn, just in the sense that, like, here's a guy you've either never ever thought about or barely thought about. Well, we know he's got a great curveball. We can see he's taken a step forward. If he can ever stay healthy for more than, like, 10 consecutive minutes, he could be interesting. And before we move on, I will say nobody really has even thought about the Oakland A's at all this year. But that pitching staff could potentially be really cool, right? Kendall Graveman is... throws nothing but sinkers, which I find hilarious. Jarrell Cotton, who throws this sort of screwball changeup that could be really interesting. Sean Manea, Andrew Triggs. Like, these are guys you don't know, but every single one of them is interesting in some way. Like, I actually kind of find that pitching rotation fascinating.
Yeah, you obviously, it makes you wonder. Obviously, there's a little bit of, you know, a little bit of good fortune probably within it, because a lot of these are kind of like low end pickups. But like, the A's certainly saw something in these guys, and you know, Cotton's had his ups and downs, literally, being sent down to the minors. But it's Oakland. They always do. They still get a little funky with their transactions, and you're seeing some results here.
Well, I'm looking at our list here of fewest barrels per ball in play. So basically, the pitchers who are avoiding the most dangerous contact the best. Alex Wood's on this list. Jesse Hahn's on this list. Andrew Triggs is on this list. Jarrell Cotton's on this list. Irvin Santana, who we just talked about, is on this list. And at the top, Joe Biagini, who I would probably have to give you 30 guesses for you to figure out what team he's on. It's the Blue Jays. He was a Rule 5 pick last year. So anyway, that's an interesting list, the guys who avoid the hardest contact. Now, speaking of hard contact, this is something that hitters want to do as often as they can. And I know for like the last 2 weeks, Matt's been really excited about. There's a couple of hitters who have had zero barrels this year. And I'm not even talking about like D. Gordon. I'm talking about like really good, above average, solid hitters. There's still two guys who have had at least 100 balls in play who have not had one barrel, and they're two all-stars.
Yeah, this is my favorite stat thus far. You hate to kind of root against guys, but I'm kind of rooting for this to maintain for as long as possible. There are 174 players with 100 bat. I think I brought this up on the podcast a couple weeks ago. I can't tell because I talk about this all the time, so I can't remember if I brought it up, but I'm gonna go with it anyway. 174 players entering play on Thursday with at least 100 balls in play. There are only two out of those 174 who have zero barrels, and they happen to be a double play combination on the same team. Dustin Pedroia and Xander Bogaerts. And Bogaerts is the one that really surprised me. There was a third guy on that list, Josh Harrison, but he got a barrel last night.
He finally got a barrel last night. He's off the Schneid. Have we gone so far in the show where we don't have to explain barrels anymore? Can we just assume everybody knows a barrel?
I'll give a quick explanation. It starts at 98 miles per hour exit velocity with a window of 26 to 30 degree launch angle. And as your exit velocity goes up, the launch angle window goes up. So you can get a barrel at like 118 miles an hour, even at like, you know, seven-degree launch angle. The idea is to identify things that are likely to be extra base hits.
It's the perfect combination between launch angle and exit velocity with an expected average of at least 500 and a slugging percentage of 1,500. It's like the best thing a hitter can do. It's the best thing a pitcher can avoid.
And like, I think either last night or the night before, I've become such a so predictable that like I think Bogaerts had one that was like 106 and 17, so he basically just missed the barrel zone. And like, Andrew Simon, one of our researchers, was like, "Oh, like I think Bogaerts got a barrel." And we looked it up. You know, he just missed. So he's still at zero. I mean, to me, Dave Cameron wrote about this at FanGraphs recently. To me, Bogaerts is a fascinating player because, in terms of like his athleticism, and you know, he's listed at 6'1", 210. I think he's probably at this point in his career, he's 24 years old. He's probably weighs more than that, but that's probably what he weighed when he, you know, first cracked the 40-man roster. He looks the part of, you know, one of these classic, you know, the new breed of shortstops, the Correas, you know, going back a little bit to, you know, Nomar, A-Rod, Jeter, like that kind of group. And from an overall production standpoint, based on his defense and the fact that he hits for a high average, he sort of fits, but he doesn't really hit for power. I mean, granted, he did have 28 barrels last year, but that's not an elite number. The league leader had like
almost 80. Yeah, over 70. I think the league leader right now is Chris with a K Davis, who has 25, I want to say, like that.
24. So it's like, yeah. You know, so even last year, a great year for him, he wasn't really barreling the ball up that right. regularly.
But now he's got zero.
And what's fascinating about him, and this is something that Cameron talked about in his piece, is basically like, he's clearly very good at taking advantage of Fenway Park. And like, to a certain extent, you don't want to penalize him because like, if a player is able to cater what he does to the park that he plays in, and if you're a right-handed hitter playing in Boston, just like Pedroia did earlier in his career, being able to sort of like cater your swing to hit high fly balls to left field, there are, you know, you probably would be wise to do that. But like this, the thing I've noticed about it is that depends on the ballpark that you are, players in the public perception, it changes much more than others. I'll give you a perfect example comparing Bogaerts to a guy who plays on the Rockies, where anyone is on the Rockies who puts up good numbers, everyone says, oh, he's a product of Coors Field. Bogaerts' career line at home, 314, 371, 451. On the road, 265, 313, 378. He slugs 378 away from Fenway Park. There's a stat on Baseball Reference called TOPS, and I'll try to explain it here. Mike, you can tell me if I'm doing it right. Basically, TOPS takes what you're like, it acknowledges what your like baseline, your average OPS is, and sets that as 100. And in a given split, whatever you do better or worse than that, you get points higher or lower. So 117, his OPS at TOPS at home is 117, which means he's 17 percentage points better than like what you would essentially expect from him in a neutral environment.
So in this case, it's not above league average, which is how these 100 plus stats usually are. It's against his own average as the average. So in this ballpark, he might be 117. In some other ballpark, he might be 98. It's a split against himself.
So home, he's 117. Road, he's 83. Let's look at Nolan Arenado. Home line overall, 307 this career, 307, 353, 580. Road, 264, 311, 468. TOPS at home, 117. TOPS on the road, 83.
Now, I'm no scientist, but those sound very similar to me.
Identical. So essentially what we're saying is that Bogaerts benefits as much from Fenway Park as Nolan Arenado
does at Coors Field.
Did I just blow your minds? I hope I did.
My mind is blown.
And to give you just another example of Carlos Gonzalez, who's basically played his entire career at Coors Field. I'd forgotten that he debuted with the A's. Like, I looked him up today. I was like, oh, I'd forgotten he played like half a season with the A's. He's 125 at home and 78 on the road for his career. So, you know, he's even more a wider extreme than either of those guys. And you see that with guys in the Rockies regularly, but the point remains that other guys kind of get that benefit from their home park too. Players often perform better at home for a variety of reasons. They can cater their swing to the dimensions. They're more familiar with the batter's eye. You know, maybe they just sleep better at home. There's a variety of reasons for it. And you shouldn't necessarily penalize a guy for it, but like we need to acknowledge that Xander Bogaerts is the perfect example of a guy who really benefits from his home park.
Yeah, I find that the way that you found that to be exactly the same as Nolan Arenado, I think that's really interesting because I never really thought about it that way. But what's kind of interesting is this, you know, as you said, these guys are a double play combination. And this is sort of a team-wide endemic for the Red Sox this year, that the offense, you know, the offense has been okay, but the power just hasn't been there. So if you look at team barrels headed into today's games, the Red Sox have 64 barrels, and that is tied with the Giants for the second fewest in all of baseball, only ahead of Pittsburgh. And we know that the Pittsburgh's had their problems. At the top of that list is Detroit. You know, Miguel Cabrera, JD Martinez, Alex Avila, who's hitting literally everything in sight right now. Oakland, and that's, remember, this doesn't account for contact, so that's how you have Chris with a K. Davis, who's really helping them. Ryan Healy.
Chad Pinder, who hit one 400.
Yonder Alonso. I mean, I'm suddenly very interested in the A's, apparently. Last year, the Red Sox had the eighth most barrels, right? And now they are down to tied for the second most. And I think we expected this to some extent. Like, David Ortiz is gone. Mitch Moreland isn't as powerful as a hitter. But you kind of also expected, well, Andrew Benintendi, you'll get a full season out of him, right? You'll got another year out of Mookie Betts and Jackie Bradley. And it hasn't really happened yet.
Well, there's two things that I think are interesting about this. One of which, you know, we've talked about Betts before as someone who sort of like outperforms his quality of contact for a couple of reasons. One of which is Fenway Park. And I think he sort of falls into a little bit into what we're talking about with Bogaerts, the guy who, you know, isn't a pure power hitter and is able to kind of cater his swing to work in Fenway the way Pedroia did when he, you know, won the MVP, which is almost hard to believe in retrospect, but it happened.
I vaguely remember that.
but also seeing Boston and Houston on this list, two of the, you know, more talented, pure talent lineups on pure talent in baseball, and also having two very similar left field dimensions, you do wonder if there are players on those teams, particularly right-hand hitters, who are maybe sacrificing some barrels in the attempt to hit high fly balls, knowing that they can get essentially cheap home runs. Last night we saw Alex Bregman hit the lowest exit velocity home run of the season. It was 88.3 miles per hour. And the inning before, Jose Iglesias hit one 90.3 right into the Crawford boxes in Houston. So I do wonder if, you know, now that we are that much more aware of players catering their swings to try and hit certain types of balls. I do wonder if that is a factor for those two teams.
What I've learned about since working with StatCast is that the ballparks I talk about most often, it's not even Coors Field. It's Detroit and it's Houston. Like, we're always talking about center field in Detroit and the corners in Houston because it just changes the game so much.
Yeah, Manny Randhawa wrote a piece about this for the site last night. Kind of this is where I kind of got this info on the Iglesias and Bregman home runs, that when it comes to the easiest ballparks to hit quote-unquote cheap home runs, we define that as the highest percentage of home runs that are neither barreled or solid contact, so like sort of like the two best of our six batted ball classifications, the two best are barrels and solid contact, which is basically a small sliver just shy of a barrel.
So we have six. You're eliminating the two best, and three of them are just bad for the hitter. So basically we're talking about that one narrow band where home runs go out.
Yeah, and essentially 16% of home runs at Minute Maid are neither barrels or solid contact, which is by far the highest in baseball. Number two is Yankee Stadium at like 11%, and which I think when you think about it makes sense. Like, Yankee Stadium has in one known area where you can get cheap home runs. Houston has two right down the right field line. We inducted Marwin Gonzalez.
Yeah, we sure did.
with a 4% hit probability home run a couple weeks ago down the right field line. And left field line, or even basically left field in general in Houston, is like a whole, you know, area for cheap home runs. On the opposite end of the spectrum, you have Busch Stadium. Only 2% of home runs are not barreled or solid contact. So in a certain way, that's the toughest park. To hit a home run there, you actually have to really, really clobber it.
You have you've stumbled upon the first step towards park factors for StatCast, which we're going to get there. Let's finish off the show by inducting a play into the Hall of Fame. We've teased this a little bit before. It actually is one of our plays that changed by a guy going back, and it was also just interesting for like four other reasons. So Tuesday in Los Angeles, Dodgers-Cardinals, top 10. Game is tied 1-1 in the 10th inning. Yadi Merlin is batting. Yadi crushes a ball to right center field. And from center field in comes Jock Peterson. And from right field in comes Yasiel Puig.
Out goes.
Well, out goes, right? And right on the lip of the warning track, they basically run directly into one another. And, you know, Yasiel Puig at full speed is not a man you want to be running into. Now, Puig actually makes the catch. And, you know, he really just blew up his teammate while doing it. As Dave Roberts said about Jock Peterson, he's got cuts on his forehead, his arm. He took an elbow to his jaw, and he hit his head against the wall. So that's a catch that really, you know, you paid for that catch. So we're inducting it into the Hall of Fame for two reasons. One is because that was actually, to date, the third biggest play in terms of a difference in catch probability, because he was going back into his right. So that catch would have been a 46% catch probability play, which is a four-star play. That's pretty good. And now it's a five-star play. It's an 18% catch probability because he had to go back. And that's a huge difference to start with. But here's also the thing. This is something of a reverse Kelly Leak play. Because when we did these Kelly Leak plays, we looked at center fielders who stole the balls from their teammate. Well, Jock Peterson was actually closer in center field than Yasiel Puig was in right field. Now, they each had an identical 5.02 seconds to get there, but Jock Peterson was 86 feet away, and Yasiel Puig was 93 feet away, and yet they got there at the exact same time. The sprint speed for Jock Peterson, his fastest one-second window, 26.7 feet per second. For Yasiel Puig, 28.7 feet per second. So you can see Puig got there a little more quickly, and Puig's quote after this was amazing. We went all out for it. That's just how baseball is. I was the first to get there. When I got there, I told him I had it, and it was too late, which is, I mean, that's peak Puig right there.
It sure was. I mean, it's actually now possibly my two favorite catches of the year both happened in Dodger Stadium in an extra inning game.
Tolles, yeah.
Andrew Tolles had one like in the 13th. It was like in an extra inning game.
Giants, yeah.
An extra inning game, like diving catch. They ended up losing diving catch deep in the warning track. It was like 8% catch probability, but it happened, you know, admittedly after I'd gone to bed, so I didn't see it. But I had to relive
East Coast
it.
Bias. Yeah. So I mean, that's kind of and we're not really even doing it justice. You actually have to watch this play because they run into each other. Peterson goes down. Puig gets up and like, yeah, I got the ball, and then just slowly collapses. And I think they both left the game. Peterson didn't play last night, but he's expected to avoid the DL. Puig did play last night, so fortunately, serious injury was avoided. It's a great play. It looked great. It was a five-star play. It's a great example of how going back can change the probabilities. And it was a right fielder who had to go a further distance than his center fielder and just bowled him over in doing it. For so many reasons, it's one of my favorite plays of the year, especially the fact that no one actually got hurt.
Indeed. So Yasiel Puig and I guess Jock Peterson, welcome to the StatCast Hall of Fame.
Welcome to the most painful induction to the StatCast Hall of Fame we've had so far. That is our show for this week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Mike Petriello. Matt Myers, we'll catch you next week on the MLB.com StatCast podcast.